What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
To continue our full hour of Palestine coverage, now with Linda Sarasour, a Brooklyn-born Palestinian Muslim American activist, author, and community organizer, about current Palestine headlines and what Kamala means or doesn't to a free Palestine. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning, Kat.
Always good to hear your voice, though never under good circumstances, unfortunately. Linda, I always start the hour with the reactions by my guests to the numbers. 50,000 plus murdered, no end in sight. This recent onslaught on the school, which we'll get into more detail in a moment. I saw a recent post from you saying, quote, "It's exhausting being a Palestinian." Your reflections that we are 9 months into this iteration of the genocide.
This pretty much sums it up, Kat. I feel very exhausted, and I'm sure that it's the same feeling that many Palestinians have, especially those of us who are Palestinian Americans living in a country where on the daily basis, not only are we defending our people's right to live in Palestine, in Gaza, but we're also defending their right to die in dignity. And right now, as you have probably seen, there are different numbers that are out there. Some are upwards of 50,000 Palestinians who have been slaughtered in this 10-month plus genocide. But we also saw a research from The Lancet, L-A-N-S-E-T, which is a very reputable international scientific and medical journal, that says the numbers could be upwards of 186,000 plus people. We don't actually know how many people have died during or have died slash killed during this genocide, from people dying of starvation, from medical needs because they couldn't get their medical needs met, those who are still under the rubble. We have to remember that as buildings fall on human beings, particularly children, there could be upwards of 20,000 children that are just under the rubble that have not been rescued. So we don't actually know the number, but we know that the minimum number could be upwards of 50,000 plus. So it's just been difficult to, you know, go through the news ourselves and experience the news as Palestinians in the United States of America, and then have to experience the ways in which our media and our government respond to what's happening in Gaza. So, yeah, it's been a I don't know how to explain the last 10 plus months, but it's been a horror after horror after horror.
Tugging on the thread around the many ways in which Palestinians are being slaughtered in this moment, there's a recent UN report about contagious disease that continues to spread due to lack of clean water and other horrific conditions. We spent some time on the show talking about COVID in particular, right? People having no choice but to be in close quarters. But the disease folks are concerned about right now is hepatitis, cases not seen in parts of the region in many years, no access to vaccines, and certainly not treatment. Your reflections there?
Yeah, I think when people think of genocide and they hear us saying that there's a genocide in Gaza, people assume that what we mean only is the bloodshed, the children being blown up into pieces, the families right now who are literally being given bags of body parts and being told, this is your family member, just take it and bury it and have the service. And people don't realize that there is so much more to genocide than just the actual bombing and bloodshed. It is forced starvation. It is disease, particularly that for vulnerable people like children, like elderly. There are people in Gaza who, before the genocide started, were suffering from cancer, from other terminally ill diseases, and no longer have access to treatment. So again, the numbers and the horror that is being experienced in Gaza based on the lack of medical treatment, medical care, and also any type of, you know, preventative services. I mean, even the humanitarian missions that go to Gaza, and there have been many that have went in the last 10 plus months, many of whom are American doctors of different backgrounds. What they go to do there is emergency services, pediatric surgeons, people trying to save limbs of children, people just trying to save as many lives as possible. So it's just been difficult for people to understand that genocide is more than just, you know, direct slaughter. It could be slow, it could be torturous. And because of the lack of aid that is entering Gaza, the lack of access to clean water, we're going to see even more high rates of hepatitis and other types of diseases or airborne diseases, plaguing the most vulnerable people in Gaza.
And even the type of aid that's coming in, right? Because something else that we've talked about on the show is once you get to a certain place in terms of starvation, right? Your body's deteriorating, eating mm-hmm. itself literally. Just dropping a box of food sometimes on the heads of the people that need it so desperately, like that's not going to cut it, right? That Israel turning away doctors whose politics or backgrounds they're concerned about. It has literally been a strategy of this iteration of the genocide to attack the medical infrastructure and to ensure people that get sick can't get well.
Yes, I mean, the state of Israel has pretty much decimated, I would say, close to 80% of the medical infrastructure of hospitals across Gaza. They have bombed hospital after hospital after hospital, sometimes one hospital multiple times, killing not only the patients and medical providers, but also civilians who are sheltering around these hospitals. And that's why in the beginning of the genocide, when people would say, oh, we don't believe that they bombed the hospital, or when Israel would make claims that terrorists were operating from inside the hospitals, and people were really adamant about doubling down on that. And now we are 10 months later, and Israel has bombed every hospital in Gaza multiple times. And, you know, knowing that their infrastructure is, even when you do get medical care in Gaza, it is the bare minimum of what you can get there. And that's why there have been people that have either died because of lack of access to medical care, or there's been a few people that have been able to evacuate to Egypt and Turkey and other places to get medical care. And we know that the state of Israel protected citizens who were literally blocking aid on the Erez border from entering Gaza. I mean, you know that there are children that are starving there, and people, Israeli citizens were blocking aid to enter Gaza. The Rafah border, as you know, is the border that is with Egypt and Gaza, and limited aid has entered. And so over the course of the last 10 plus months, it has literally the type of aid that is necessary to enter Gaza has been drop in the bucket. And you know, at some point the United States government built a pier that we knew wasn't really for aid, but they already even broke that down. At some point the United States government was dropping aid in airplanes that were dropping and actually killing people. Like, this is not the dignified way to present aid to people who are in need. So it's just been horrific on so many levels, not only watching the bloodshed, but also watching the lack of care for the civilians of Gaza, even as something as simple like we live in the most powerful country in the world. Like, there is no competition with the power that the United States government has. And the fact that you don't have the power to demand that the state of Israel that you fund, that you bankroll, doesn't at least at the minimum allow for unlimited aid to get into the people of Gaza is absolutely shameful on behalf of the United States.
Lynn, I'm going to bring into the conversation now Sahar Francis, General Director of Ramallah-based Adamir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, a Palestinian organization providing legal and advocacy support to Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli and Palestinian prisons. She is also an attorney by training. Good morning, Sahar.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. Sahar, Linda Sahar, I'm assuming you all probably have crossed paths. Linda, sure. We're talking about bombing hospitals, I'll let you say y'all's greetings. Sorry.
Yes, of course. We actually also crossed paths right here on Cat Brook Show.
Exactly.
It's been a lot of Mondays. Not just bombing of hospitals, but also bombing of schools. Last 24 hours saw a horrific attack on a school, 100 dead, 150 injured. Bomb matched the U.S. MK-84 bombs. Clear that this bomb was made in the United States. Linda, I'll start with your reaction. Sahara, I'll go to you.
Oh, my goodness, Kat. Like,
I mean,
it's been, I don't even know what to say. I don't know if people have seen some of the imagery that has come out after this last a school bombing in Gaza City. I mean, these are people, it was 4:40 a.m., which is, as many people know, for Muslims, is the beginnings of our kind of prayers for the day, the Fajr prayer, which is the early, early morning prayer. People lined up and boom, they bombed the school. And the civilian defense in Gaza basically said that there was not a body that was whole. Every body was either lost some sort of part of their body part, or some were not even recognizable. And to the point where when families were looking for their loved ones, you would tell the civilian defense, for example, my husband is in there, and they would say, well, how much did your husband weigh? And you would say something like, you know, my husband weighed, you know, 40 kilograms or 50 kilograms. And they would literally give you a bag of body parts that was equivalent to that weight, you know, 18 kilograms if it was a smaller child or tween. And that's the kind of horror that we're talking about here. This is beyond the imagination, beyond description. Of course, you know, I always remind people here on your show, Kat, a quote from Ida B. Wells, an investigative Black journalist during the civil rights movement, that said, those who commit the murders write the reports. And of course, the state of Israel continues to lie, as they did from the beginning of the genocide till now, to claim that they were doing some sort of targeted operation. But 100 people plus were murdered. They ripped them to shreds. And it was ripped. They were ripped to shreds by American bombs. And most recently, as you know, Joe Biden pretty much you know, sent a $3.5 billion additional of funds and weapons to the state of Israel just within the last week. And so what we know here is that every time any American in this country is watching videos of Palestinians blown up to smithereens, where family members are carrying their loved ones in plastic bags, know that an American bomb did that to them, that we did that to them, that our taxpayer dollars did that to them. So it's just, I stopped finding the words, Kat, to describe how I'm feeling about these things, the lack of humanity of the world, and really the shamefulness of the United States of America, the most powerful entity in the world, that literally has a lot of power that they are not using nor leveraging in this moment to get a ceasefire in Gaza and to demand that the state of Israel withdraw from Gaza and allow the Palestinian people to start a journey towards their self-determination.
Sahar?
Yes, I totally agree with what Linda was describing. But I would just like to add that for me, as a lawyer, in all these actions that the Israeli occupation is doing by the support of the United States, is also affecting the elaboration and the understanding of the limits of the international humanitarian law and international human rights law. Actually, all the time, the Israeli claim that there were militant people in this school or that place that they bombed in order to justify the horrific attack and killings of civilians in such brutal, awful way, is another way in order to change what would be defined as a legitimate target under international humanitarian law and international human rights law. And this is very dangerous. This was done in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in other contexts by the United States. And the fact that the United States was not found accountable for all the war crimes and crimes against humanity that they committed in these places enables Israel today to commit the genocide in Gaza without fear that they would be accountable one day or not.
A recent report by, I'm going to say it wrong, B'Tselem, please feel free to correct me. Welcome to Hell, the Israeli prison system as a network of torture camps has been released. Sahar, can you talk to us about torture as a form of a policy, right? Like a lot of times people will blame things like rape or starvation or beatings, right, on the culture of incarceration. Here we're talking about rape as policy inside of these prisons, correct?
Yes, actually, the report of B'Tselem is a kind of summary for what the Palestinian, especially the Palestinian organizations working on the prisoners' issues, were discussing and highlighting and trying to push for decades now. The rape and the sexual violence is not a new policy, although there were periods that they stopped using actual rape in detention and as a form of torture and very awful crime against the prisoners. But rape was used in the early years of the occupation in the 70s and the 80s as part of the process of the torture. The physical torture was always, and the mental torture as well was always, a very essential part of the process of the interrogation inside the Israeli interrogation centers. It's not new that they are torturing people in the interrogation. What we were witnessing after the 7th of October, and actually this is what B'Tselem report came to highlight, the total circumstances and the whole policies that were implemented against the whole community of the prisoners, more than 9,900 people sitting inside the Israeli prisons, Palestinians, they are facing more or less the same brutality, the same torture, the same degrading treatment, the starvation policies, the punishments, the physical attacks, the sexual harassment, including sexual violence and rape in lots of cases. Actually, in all my practice as a lawyer, more than 25 years, I've never witnessed such a widespread policy of sexual harassment against the prisoners, against children, elderly, women, men. Everyone would be the strip search that is imposed in different levels of the detention is accompanied with lots of verbal and physical sexual assaults against the detainees. The conditions inside the prisons since October 7th are very difficult. It's a very systematic policy, and it's coming from the highest level of the political level inside the state. It's the Minister of Security that is always in every platform talks about the prisoners' issues and how happy he is with all these policies that he's implementing inside the prisons, actually.
Linda, reflections?
I mean, it's been, I don't even, again, just finding words, Kat, to describe the Israeli government and members of parliament who literally were debating whether or not it was a legitimate to rape Palestinians. We watched Israeli citizens, some Israeli citizens, literally standing outside a jail, demanding justice for Israeli soldiers who had raped Palestinian prisoners. We saw a video that the whole world saw of Israeli soldiers raping one Palestinian prisoner on video, and just the ways in which the conversation has ensued. While this is the most horrific and outrageous thing that we could see, watching, to your point, that this is policy. There was a debate about whether raping Palestinians was legitimate, or it's just the depravity of the Israeli government and the occupation is exposing itself to the world, Kat, and what we've been experiencing and our families have been experiencing for over 76 years is now bare to see for the world. And we have, as a world, as a society, decide if we are going to allow this to continue to happen. And I'm hoping that the horror that the Palestinian people have experienced is not in vain, and that this exposure to the horror that the Palestinians have experienced and will continue to experience if we do not help end this occupation, help end the siege on Gaza, is something that is going to move people all around the world to demand better and to be bolder in our demands when it comes to the state of Israel.
when I read about these things and I put it inside of the context of, right, like even if a ceasefire happened right now, right this second, bomb stopped falling, experiencing things like rape, torture, starvation, et cetera, that has long-term impacts on our mental, emotional health, our ability to function, right? We know complex PTSD can be debilitating for folks. Sahar, can you talk about when folks do exit these places of torture, long-time ramifications of what has happened to them inside?
Definitely. And I think it's not just affecting the person himself. Of course, the most serious impact would be on the detainee himself. And believe me, it's horrible, because in meetings, lawyers, that they are implementing meetings with these prisoners, that they talk about these horrible conditions. It's very difficult even for the lawyers how to deal with all these cases. It's really a widespread policy. It's almost everyone that is detained currently in the occupied territories would face different ways and methods and levels of torture and ill treatment, including sexual harassment. And this means the impact would be also affecting the families of these people when they are released and when they want to discuss it and talk about it with their family members. And I think the Israelis are really aware about the impact of such torture on the Palestinian society. And this is why it's always used intentionally in order to leave this impact beyond the years or the months that you spend inside the prisons. It's meant to be that it will follow for decades after, and it's affecting whole generations in Palestine. Imagine arresting more than 700, 800 children just in 6-7 months. Isn't it intentional to affect a whole generation of people under 18 by this harsh experience that they would get through in these interrogation rooms and in the conditions in the prisons?
Linda, I just have a few minutes left with you, and I don't want to let you go without getting some of your reflections on some of the shenanigans happening at the federal level in politics here in the United States. Joe Biden has dropped out of the race. Kamala Harris has been is the Democratic Party nominee. as if the people will have amnesia that she's been the vice president the entire time that the U.S. has been sending money and bombs to Israel to carry out this genocide. The first thing I thought was identity politics, right? Hey, here's a black face. Maybe you'll trust this face to bomb people in your names more than you trusted the white face. But I'd just love to get, because we're so short on time, your general reflections, the fact that Palestine's being used as a political football right now, and that the what it also seems to be said to us is like, okay, here, well, it won't be genocide, Joe, but here's this. So now everybody be quiet, go to the polls, vote for Kamala, because there's this other evil thing lurking in the corner, as if one is better than the other.
Now, my general reflection, Kat, is that, you know, Kamala Harris has a long track record, and particularly statements and actions in unequivocal support to the state of Israel before she was even the vice president of the United States of America. Her track record as a United States senator, her trips and comments that she made when she was Attorney General of California. And so the burden's on her, not on us. If you want to claim that you're going to disassociate yourself from the politics of this White House during this genocide, then it's on you to prove that to the people. It's not on us as voters. And I think it was just despicable to watch how people were responding to protesters who showed up in a rally for her in Detroit, as if because Kamala Harris became the nominee, we're just supposed to wait around. We're just supposed to, you know, sit at home and watch our people get slaughtered and just hope that things get better. When has it ever been, Kat, that we just sit around and allow any candidate or any presidential candidate just sit around and just wait to see what happens? We don't have time to wait. This is life and death we're talking about on the line. So I'm just, you know, really disappointed in a lot of our colleagues that immediately when Kamala became the nominee, everyone kind of forgot where we are, forgot where what was going on. And I think that there's a balance here for folks who want to support Kamala Harris and want to defeat Donald Trump in November, knowing that Donald Trump, we know this, we're Muslims, we're Arabs, we understand what Donald Trump means for our community because we experienced him before too. So this idea that people would lecture us about, oh, do you want Donald Trump? Is that what you want? No, we don't want Donald Trump. We want an end to genocide. We want an administration that's going to conduct themselves under international humanitarian law. We want an administration who implements the Leahy law and says that we should not be giving our money to countries that have clearly proven that they violate human rights and are violating international law and code. And so, you know, I'm just sitting here, Kat, continuing to do my work and to do my job, which is to organize. And you know me, Kat, I'm not the one that's going to get the invitations to the White House, and I don't care because our people, our communities are worth more than us being quiet in this moment. And I'll end by saying this, you know, people will say to us, Kat, oh, you're one issued people. That's not fair. What about other communities? And you know me, Kat, I've been outside for many communities outside of my own. And I say to people all the time, if genocide ain't your moral litmus test, if genocide ain't the red line for you, then I don't know what the red line. And I don't believe that you care about any community anywhere, including your own, if you can't even in this moment say, I want to end a genocide that's happening in my generation that I'm watching right now live every day, 24 hours a day. So it's been, that's the exhausting part of this all. Just watching this conversation unfold and really appreciate people like you, Kat, who are just going to tell the truth no matter what. People who put the people first and put our people first. So I appreciate you.
I appreciate you, sister, deeply. And I appreciate you both for taking time out to talk to my listeners this morning. We'll have you back soon. Take care.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.